questions. Please give us, please finish your response and then go to our questions. We'd appreciate it. Anyone have any questions?
None, Your Honor.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
No, Your Honor, other than to let you know that I think we would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, and if you each would say your name just so, because it's gonna be recorded, so they have your voices. So why don't you go first?
Go ahead. Certainly, Your Honor. Michael Lieber, on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Gregory Mayer, we'll reserve 5 minutes. And let us know when you would like us to officially start the argument.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Margarita M. Albarello on behalf of the defendant appellee Hollister Incorporated.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lieber, you may begin.
May it please the court, Michael Lieber on behalf of the plaintiff appellant Gregory Mayer. Mr. Mayer seeks reversal of this court's of the circuit court's judgment and a remand for further proceedings. The circuit court erred in dismissing Greg's amended complaint. Greg alleged 4 causes of action with particularity. The circuit court improperly relied on affidavits from Hollister employees as affirmative matter, even though
we've read the briefs.
Sure.
We've read the record, the decisions by the lower court on the first complaint and then on the amended complaint. We're very familiar. A lot of documents and a very hefty complaint, amended complaint. So just to begin, my question is, let's talk about the first two issues are a little different than the second two, because the first two, count one and count two, both only involved a 2619 with regard to affirmative matter and nothing else. So with regard to those cases, what is your best argument as to why the affidavits do not provide affirmative matter that negates the claims?
Yes, Your Honor. For both the Whistleblower Act claim count one and the retaliatory discharge count two, our complaint alleges in detail that Greg was asked to take action, that he refused, and that he controlled the IP law team's budget. We allege this both at length in the complaint.
What's the action, Mr. Lieber, that he was asked to take?
He was asked to accept $43,000 into a budget that he held, and he would have to accept that at 12:01 a.m. on January 1st.
Was he accepting that, or was that just simply placed in his budget by his general counsel?
Well, it's kind of two sides of the same coin. Because Greg controlled that budget, when his general counsel said, "Look, I want to hide and park this money there," even though that Greg knew that it would violate prohibitions by the CEO on budgetary reserves in the legal budget, and would violate some antitrust issues that Hollister and its sister company held itself out as soon as Greg accepted that money into an account that he held, he would be doing things in violation of Rule 8.4C.
This is not his personal account. This was the account of the company.
That's
not the same as holding money in your personal account, hiding it. This is the company's budget, the company's account.
That's correct, but it's an account that he controls as a lawyer, and I would liken it to the case of Young versus Alden Gardens. In Young versus Alden Gardens, the nurse there who complained and was retaliated against and was ultimately discharged, she was told to make false representations on medical records. Now, those weren't her personal records. Those were the medical records of the nursing home. This is the budget, admittedly, of the company, but a budget that Greg himself controls. And as a lawyer—
Labor, excuse me, how does he control it? Did he have the authority to reject it and say, no, I'm not gonna accept this budget, go back to the drawing board, come back with another one? Or was he someone that just was going to be required, since he was not part of, from what I understand from reading the pleadings, he was not part of the internal process of creating the budget. Wasn't he merely a figurehead to accept whatever budget they gave him? How does he control it?
Your Honor, not exactly. He controlled most parts of the creation of the budget. The one sliver that he didn't control was when his boss, Tim Murphy, took it to the higher-ups at the parent company for approval. And then once the money was put into the budget as of 12:01 a.m. on January 1st, Greg controlled all aspects of it. And as a matter of fact, Hollister does not even dispute that. Greg was in charge of paying the bills, of hiring.
Who controlled what the amount of the budget was? In other words, who controlled the amount of money that Greg received?
Well, in this
case, I'm using the term Greg, not to be at all condescending just because you used that.
No, I think it's probably easier. It's perfectly fine, Your Honor. The number was chosen by the top people at the parent company, the firm of John Dickinson Schneider. But they chose a different number than what Greg was ultimately going to get, because recall, Greg's boss decided to hide or park this money and told Greg, I need you to participate in the hiding or parking of this $43,000.
Let's look at the that to me is very telling that Murphy used the words hide and park. The word hide, if it was something that was legal, you would say you would hide something. You don't hide something that's legal. And park sounds like they're putting it there for other purposes. They're parking it there. It's not permanent. It's going to be used for other purposes, which is what Murphy said. And then you have the Hollister instructions to maintain reserves, that there are no reserves to be maintained in the legal budget. So, and apparently Hollister had pretty tight a code of conduct. You would agree to that too.
Your Honor, I would. And as a matter of fact, we allege in our complaint that the night that Greg got that email, the hide or park email, anytime you hear the words hide or park as a lawyer, you're going to be concerned. And we even allege that Greg had trouble sleeping that night. Greg was an extraordinarily ethical lawyer who took an extraordinarily difficult step of refusing to do this. And he paid the ultimate professional price. He was fired. And you know, from that day until now, he has not been, he is not working as in-house lawyer anymore.
Right, so let's go back to the 2619. When you read the affidavit, this whole thing, and you say it in your briefs, I mean, you mentioned it at least in passing, that this is in a nature of a summary judgment procedure. And you quote a case about summary judgment. Can you expand on that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. In a 2619 motion, the facts as alleged in the complaint and the counter affidavits have to be taken as true. The circuit court did not do that. We alleged at length that Greg was instructed to take action, that he refused to take action, that he controlled the budget. A number of other things regarding the second two counts, a number of things as well. We can perhaps get into that later. The fact of the matter is we alleged all of this, and essentially what Hollister offered was affidavits that say, not true, he's not right, Greg didn't control this. But that's not what a 2619 motion is about. A 2619 motion has to accept as true the well-pled allegations of the complaint. As you say, this is a lengthy complaint, admittedly, but we plead these claims with granular specificity of what Greg was asked to do, what he was told to do. And all they come back with is affidavits saying it's not true. It's kind of like if you have a situation where, you know, a traffic accident case and the complaint says the light was red and the other side comes back with an affidavit saying, no, the light was green. That's not a 2619 motion. Right. That's summary judgment.
Well, and again, and you just mentioned, but to me, it's something that it's important is that they've admitted that you've made a claim. Your claim is good, right? A 2619 admits that you have pled a claim.
That's correct, Your Honor. And yet a lot of this stems, I think, from the circuit court's fundamental misunderstanding of what this case is about. Our initial complaint alleged these same things that Greg did, that he refused to take these actions because of Rule 8.4C and its federal counterpart that relates to patent lawyers such as him, because he was concerned about impermissible budgetary reserves and the KMT, the sister company antitrust issues. It also alleged one other thing. It alleged that Greg reasonably believed that by moving this money from KMT to Hollister and back and forth, that could amount to tax fraud or at least false statements to the government on Hollister's part. As part of the dismissal motion of the initial complaint, Hollister offered up an affidavit from one of their assistant treasurers who said the money all belongs in one pot because the parent company files joint tax returns for all of them. As a result, in our amended complaint, we removed that tax fraud claim. The judge, the circuit court judge, though, moored his dismissal of the amended complaint to that notion of, hey, this money is all in one big pot, so it doesn't matter how it's used. Now, that might be true for the tax fraud purposes, but if Greg is accepting and holding and hiding and spending money that's part of an impermissible legal reserve, he's being forced to lie to his CEO, his client, who said no budgetary reserves. He's also being forced to essentially lie to the public and government regulators worldwide when he's saying Hollister and KMT are completely walled off from each other.
Well, and that's what happened. What happened to the judge's order, what he calls an opinion, he doesn't talk about the fact that he was exonerated after at the investigation stage, that he was, what he had done was proper.
That he had
what he did. And then this happens. And the affidavits sound like we're in a Twilight Zone world where he's wrong. Can you explain how you see that?
That's correct. Hollister claims that Greg, and this really more goes to the reasonableness issue of whether he could have reasonably believed that there was a wrong going on here. We know that he was reasonable because after he reported it to his boss, his boss reported it to his boss, who hired an outside law firm to investigate. And ultimately, as Your Honor just said, that outside law firm said, Greg, you did nothing wrong in reporting this.
And the firm also found that Murphy did nothing wrong. The argument that the other side is making here is that no laws were violated in. There's nothing in your complaint, they argue, that states that a law or a rule or regulation was violated.
We are on a 2619 motion. And this goes to reasonable belief. Greg does not have, at this stage of the game, the requirement of showing that a law was broken. I believe it's the Palmateer case that addresses this and a number of others that say, on a complaint and in response to a 2619 motion, all you need to do is show that you reasonably believed that a law was being broken. I would also state, Your Honor, that we have not seen this report. There has been no discovery. All we know is that they claim that this lawyer looked into what his boss was doing and if you look at Mr. Schiller's affidavit, who was the outside lawyer, he said, I determined that Mr. Murphy was not involved in any kind of tax fraud problems. Again, that's not the legal violation that's at issue here. What that outside lawyer did not look at was whether Mr. Murphy or whether my client Greg was violating Rule 8.4C of the Illinois Rules of Professional Conduct. I would like to just say one quick item about the third and fourth count, promissory estoppel and fraudulent inducement. The circuit court committed yet additional reversible error on those two counts because, first of all, the court found that Greg could not rely on the promises of the code of conduct because the 2015 code of conduct, because his 2007 employment contract was an at-will employment contract. So they could fire him for any reason. The problem is the complaint and that employment contract and our affidavit all show that that contract could be augmented if it is in writing and signed by the president of Hollister. The code of conduct, which came 7 years later, was in writing and was signed by the president of Hollister. We allege this. We allege it in the complaint, in the affidavit, and it says that right there in the employment contract, which was one of the exhibits attached to Hollister's declarations. Given that, that code of conduct augmented the 2007 employment agreement and essentially said, Greg can't be fired for no reason at all. He can't be fired if he raises concerns of wrongdoing at the company. He will be protected from retaliation. The circuit court judge ignored that. And as a matter of fact, the circuit court judge's opinion cites zero case law, except for the standard governing 2619 motion and the elements of each of the four things. Greg is an Illinois lawyer who took his ethical responsibilities extraordinarily seriously here. The circuit court wrote a bare bones skeletal opinion, which largely cut and pasted from its earlier opinion related to a very different first complaint. Greg is an Illinois lawyer who upheld the rules set forth by our Illinois Supreme Court, deserves better. We deserve a reversal and a remand so we can go through discovery proceedings and prove our case. If Hollister has factual issues, which is all they've done is raise factual issues here, the time to do that is not on a 2619 motion. The time to do that is on summary judgment or at trial.
Any other questions? All right, thank you. You'll have your 5 minutes.
Thank you.
You may proceed, please.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Again, Margarita Alvarello on behalf of Defendant Appellee Hollister Incorporated. May it please the court and counsel. The circuit court did not err, and it's all of the circuit courts, all of the trial court's rulings should be confirmed and affirmed. I'll start out with the Section 20 whistleblower claim because it is really the overarching concept of all four claims. And that is that Mr. Meyer's allegations boil down to the fact that General Counsel Tim Murphy's business decision, whether Mr. Meyer disagreed with it or agreed with it, that was an internal business decision made by Mr. Murphy concerning the company's own money that the company was aware of.
So if that's under 619, you admitted the claim, correct?
Yes, we admitted the well-clad facts.
You've admitted the claim. He's made a good claim.
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay.
Correct.
Now, what you just said with regard to internal decision-making, isn't that a question of fact?
No, Your Honor, it's not.
Why not? You're saying these under these facts, it isn't. I mean, that's a question to be determined at a later date, maybe a summary judgment possibility, but there hasn't been any discovery. So at this juncture, why is this, those affidavits, how do they negate the claim? It has to be a full negation.
Yes, the affidavits do negate the claim in the following manner. Number one, let me start out with by stating that the amended complaint does not state, it does not allege that this was not a business decision by Mr. Murphy. Nowhere in the complaint does it state that. It unequivocally alleges that this $43,000 allocation to the intellectual property law budget team was Mr. Murphy's decision. No bones about it. What Mr. Meyer quibbles with is whether or not he, quote unquote, participated in an action in connection with Mr. Murphy's decision to make that internal allocation to the IP law budget. The reason that we have stated affirmative matter is that if you look at the complaint and you hold it up to the November 28th, 7:18 or 7:28 p.m. email that started this big bugaboo, the complaint is at odds with the very language of Mr. Murphy's email. And the law in Illinois is clear that a court can consider documents.
Before you get to the law, in what ways is it conflicting with the email?
Yes. The amended complaint, Your Honor, states that the email directs Mr. Meyer to hold and to use the $43,000. It doesn't say that at all. Mr. Murphy's email simply says, I have made a decision to up or hide $43,000 in the total budget, which is one big bucket, to the IP law department budget. That's
hi. What does hide mean?
Okay, I'm sorry.
But Your Honor, hide.
No. What does hide mean? My question is, what does hide mean?
Thank you. As Mr. Murphy testified in his declaration, he explained, and he also explained it in his an email to Mr. Murphy to Mr. Meyer that is attached to Mr. Murphy's affidavit. He explains that some of KMT Medical's service business units, those are the SBUs, they're not as conscientious about their.
No, I understand. I read all that.
So he's saying we're going to hide.
My question was a very simple one. When somebody uses the word hide and park, now those have special meanings, particularly by lawyers. If something's on the up and up, does somebody hide it? Just ask yes or no.
Is it on the up and up? It can be, yes.
It can be, and when you hide something, it can be.
Yes,
of course. You want to hide something, and when you want to hide something, what's that mean? You don't want somebody to see it, right? You don't want anybody to know about it. You want to keep it silent.
No, not anybody. Certain people to know about it.
Like the higher ups.
No.
No, I don't know. But what you just raised, and I appreciate it, is a lot of facts.
I disagree.
So my question to you is, are you really saying that the complaints, allegations aren't true? Isn't that really, all that those affidavits that you attach are all about facts, right? It's about facts. And it's saying, as I read it, saying they're not true. That's not true. Is that correct? You agree. You're shaking your head. Yes,
That is correct. They say that conclusions of law and conclusions of fact are not true.
So you're saying that it says that there are things that it's a not true kind of response. That's what it is, right? You're contesting the facts without any discovery.
We are testing facts that are not well pled.
Where did you say you can't say they're not well pled? I don't see anywhere. Where did you in your brief talk about not well pled? Any particular citation not well pled?
Yes.
What?
We speak at length about Mr. Meyer's not well pled allegation.
What allegation? What in your complaint? In your brief, you talk about conclusory facts. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you don't cite to one paragraph.
That's not correct, Your Honor.
Well, I've read it very carefully. And you're talking about, you don't tell us what is conclusory. And even if you tell us one paragraph is conclusory, there are 400 paragraphs and more. We're not mind readers. You're saying it's conclusory. And when you use the word conclusory, I looked up every time you use that word, and it was in a very broad context. So you can't just say, well, it's conclusory. I mean, that makes no sense to us. We don't know what you're talking about. What's conclusory? So you never put that down there specifically. Did you? We're telling me if I'm wrong.
Thank you. Let me grab my brief. Jeffs, can you grab my memorandum brief in opposition? But I'm going to do this off the top of my head while I'm getting our memorandum in support of our combined motion to dismiss the amended complaint. We specifically argue and cite to the record where Mr. Meyer alleges that Mr. Murphy in the November 28th email, PM email, tells Mr. Meyer that he has to participate in the hiding and parking of the $43,000. We argue in the brief that that is not at all what the document states. And even though Mr. Meyer didn't attach the email to his complaint, the law is clear that when a complaint puts a document not attached and complaint makes that document at issue, that a court can consider the content of that document when ruling on a motion to dismiss, either under Section 2615 or under Section 2-619. And that's the Northwest Illinois Area Agency on Aging versus Basta case, 2022 Ill App 2nd 210234. And it's also the Bajwa, B-A-J-W-A versus Metropolitan Life Insurance Company at 208 Ill Second 414 from 2004.
Let's go back. So you say that this is a not true response. That's what you said, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And when you come to affirmative defenses, it really is a question of not necessarily not true, but it's a question of yes, but. Because you said yes. You said there's a claim, but, okay? But when you say, look at these facts, that's not a yes, but. That's a not true. In the case law, if you want to talk about something that's clear, differentiates the two. And not true is not affirmative matter. In which case, we would have to reverse the first two counts. Now, tell me why we should not follow the clear law, which says that not true has to do with a factual dispute, not a yes, but. Because you keep saying it's not a yes, but, because you keep contradicting everything they're saying in their complaint.
If the complaint states that, I'm going to take a hypothetical. Mr. Meyer alleges that rather than Mr. Murphy allocating $43,000, he says Mr. Murphy allocated $100,000 to the IP budget. Now we look at the November 28th email that the plaintiff in his complaint relies upon, okay? Because he's pointing to that email concerning the hiding or parking. And we look in that email, and that email doesn't talk about $43,000. It talks about $100,000. It's contrary. We're not denying that Mr. Murphy said, I've upped the budget by hiding or parking X number of dollars. We're not disputing that he used words hide or park. What we're saying is using the terms, I upped the budget to hide or, and I'm hiding or parking $43,000, that does not get morphed into a, I'm telling you to participate in this. That's not
here's the problem though. And let's just back up a second. So the way this works is that Mr. Meyer is responsible for preparing a budget for the IP team. And once that budget is prepared, it's sent to Mr. Murphy. And then Mr. Murphy is responsible for going to the board of directors to have that budget approved. The facts in this case appear to be, because the facts are still not ironed out yet, there's been no discovery, but it appears to be that the board approved the budget that was submitted. And the budget that was submitted is the same budget that Mr. Meyer prepared. And that's the budget that was approved. After the budget was approved by the board of directors, Mr. Meyer then makes an independent decision that he's going to up that budget by $43,000, but he's asking Mr. Murphy to hide.
No, no, it's the reverse.
$43,000. Pardon?
I think you got the names reversed.
I'm sorry, Mr. Murphy is asking Mr. Meyer to hide that $43,000 in the budget. In other words, you're right. He didn't tell him to use it because he couldn't use it. It was just simply being hidden there. And that's where Mr. Meyer raises his concern, is that he's being asked to hide this money, which for all practical purposes, it hasn't been approved by the board that the money should even be in his budget, but it's there and he's supposed to hide it, such that for what reason, we don't know. But I think any reasonable person can see why Mr. Meyer would have some concerns as a lawyer that he's being asked to hide something. It's no different than your neighbor coming to you and asking you to hide his or her car in your garage. You don't know if that car has been involved in a crime, and now you're going to hide the car in your garage. You can become an accessory after the fact of a crime. So now we don't know why Mr. Murphy is asking Mr. Meyer to hide this money, but I can understand Mr. Meyer's concern. And again, here, as Mr. Lieber stated earlier, Mr. Meyer is not required to prove anything at this point. He's only required to allege facts that would allow him to go on and engage in discovery, and then he'll be required to prove these things at trial. So please respond to that, Ms. Alberillo.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, the budget that was approved by the board of directors of JDS and Hollister was one big number. They didn't simply approve, they didn't go and look at the five different law team budgets, one of which was the IP law team. They approved.
Is that in the record? That's not in the record. You're giving us facts that's not in the record. You're telling us now that they never saw the budget prepared by Mr. Meyer, that they just saw one big budget for the entire legal department, and then they approved the large budget of the legal department, not an individual budget. That's not in the record. And if it's there, you need to tell me what page that's on.
Your Honor.
And I know you don't have time to find it now because you're short on time.
Yep.
But if that's in the record, we're going to discuss this, and I believe you should submit something telling us where we can find that in the record.
Your Honor, in Mr. Murphy's supplemental declaration, and it's in the record below this particular paragraph is, it's at C543. In 2018, I did not present a fiscal year 2019 law department budget at the annual operating meeting, at the AOP meeting, because there was no need for us to do that, for me to do that. This is because Hollister's CEO and CFO told me what my target was based on historical data. So the higher ups didn't even look. They didn't even look at a budget for 2019. What they relied upon was the fiscal year 2018 budget. So they didn't even look. Secondly, you're going to, Your Honor, to the question of reasonableness, but please remember that under a Section 20 Illinois Whistleblower Act claim, his reasonableness, the plaintiff's reasonableness, is not at issue. At the end of the day, the question is whether Mr. Myers' refusal to accept the $43,000, which was already baked in to the budget from 2018, whether that would have resulted in the violation of a federal or state law, rule, or regulation. And it simply wouldn't, because as the trial court said, this is the money that belongs to the company. It's like Mr. Murphy taking money out of his right pocket and putting it into his left pocket.
Well, what you just said, to me, what I heard is a good argument from your side on a motion for summary judgment. We don't know any of those facts because there hasn't been any discovery. So what is happening here, and you, I'm not trying to beat a dead horse, but we have a factual dispute. And what you keep doing in answering the justice's questions is going back to facts, and trying to argue whether the law is this and the facts of this. That's what summary judgment is for. None of that negates wholly the claim. Summary judgment, you know, you may go to summary judgment. I don't know, but that's for the future. I'm having trouble getting around the fact that the law provides that the affirmative matter does not include factual disputes in the complaint. You're not, you're saying there's something in this claim outside of it, that says there's no claim at all. And all you're saying is, I'm not going outside, I'm going into the claim and saying there's nothing. That's summary judgment. Why am I wrong?
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor.
I know you disagree.
And one of the reasons is that Mr. Myers' amended complaint doesn't address these allegations.
No, you're not listening. I don't need to tell you that 216 has already said there's a claim. There is a valid claim. So when you say that, you're contesting the claim. You've already conceded. You don't get to 619 in this case without conceding the claim. There is a good claim.
We don't concede that there's a good claim. If I said that,
then you just conceded the case. We have to reverse. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what you just said is you do not believe what Rule 619 believes. And if you can't say that, if you're saying it's a 615 motion, when the judge did a 619, we have to reverse. You've just conceded the case.
Your Honor, I'm not following your argument.
Okay, what is the difference between a 615 motion and a 619 motion?
A 615 motion says that I agree with everything, I admit everything the plaintiff has stated, but it doesn't state a claim. For example, he's missing the argument of, or the allegation of proximate cause. A 2619 says, even if we accept as true the well-pled facts and allegations that are not conclusions of law, he has no claim as a matter of law. And that is what Mr. Murphy's affidavit establishes.
No, Mr. Murphy's affidavit is about facts. It's about not true. We've gone over this.
Your Honor.
What? Not true has been stated repeatedly by the appellate court. Not true affidavits are not affirmative matter. That's been stated repeatedly. So you can't, and as I said before, you have not told us. You have said the whole complaint, somewhere in there, there's conclusory stuff. I don't know where it is. Maybe if there's one paragraph. But how about the other 419? I mean, we cannot, your brief, this is de novo review. You have not told us You're trying to hold your cards. I'm not going to tell you, justices, what it is specifically that's illusory. Where is that in your brief? It's not there.
What is not a well-pled issue of fact or allegation of fact is when the complaint says that the email of November 28th says...
No. But you... again, you've already conceded it is well-pleaded. Because that's where you get, you said it. You told me the definitions. You know the difference. But you just said you're not going to concede this in a way that we don't know exactly what you're saying because it's not in your brief.
Your Honor, I did respectfully disagree. And may I know I'm out of time. May I make one more point?
Oh, no, we're not cutting you off. I mean, this is an important case. It's important to you.
And thank you.
And he'll have 5 minutes or more to respond. So
thank you very much. Thank you.
You were about to comment on
yes, thank you. Thank you, Justice Walker. With regard to the Section 20 claim, Mr. Meyer has to show that his refusal to accede to the conduct that was demanded of him would violate a law, rule, or regulation.
He has a plead or show. There's a difference in those two words.
Well, he's got his...
He doesn't have to show it now. He has to plead it. And that he did. He pled it because you don't agree with it. And you're saying he hasn't shown it. He doesn't have to show it. You're talking summary judgment to us. That's what I'm trying... You know, I understand that you disagree with his claims. We understand that completely. But the judge has given us no case law, basically, to go on. And many of the cases that you cite, they cite as well and read them differently. And again, at least for the first two counts, you can't have it both ways.
I'd like to cite to the Lewelling versus Schnadig case, L-E-W-E-L-I-N-G. Schnadig, S-C-H-N-A-D-I-G Corp, 276 Illep 3rd, 1st District. This is affirming the trial court's 216 granting of a motion to dismiss. This is a Section 20 retaliatory discharge claim where the plaintiff alleged that he was fired for insisting that the employer comply with federal rules and regulations in the use of interstate motor carriers. That was the allegation in the complaint. The trial court held and granted the defendant's motion to dismiss that plaintiff did not state a claim. And that was because as a matter of law and the question of whether there is a public policy involved, for example, and I know that we're talking about a Section 20 claim here, not a retaliatory discharge claim, but the court held as a matter of law that the legislation that the plaintiff was concerned about was merely economic legislation which served purely commercial interests, having nothing to do with the and did not rise to the level of a violation of a law, rule, or regulation. Judge Kubasiak was correct in ruling that Mr. Meyer could not, as a matter of law, he didn't in his amended complaint, and nor could he in any reiteration, that there was that his refusal to concede would have resulted in the violation of a law, rule, and regulation. And why is that? Because, as Judge Kubasiak said, the money is the company's money is the company's money. We don't need to get to a motion for summary judgment for a court to make that ruling. And so that's what the court did. That's what the court did in the Lewelling Schnadig case. Mr. Murphy's declaration, it goes outside of the allegations of fact. It says, this is the company's money. The CEO of Hollister and JDS is the same CEO of Hollister and, the CEO and CFO of this company is the same one as this company. The budget was approved. They didn't care how the money was used. They just wanted us to come in at or below budget.
I just checked your brief. You didn't cite the Llewellyn case, did you?
I did not.
Okay. Well, you didn't disclose that just now.
I did.
You hit it.
No.
Well,
no, Your Honor, I would have.
You didn't disclose that you did. You know, it was as if you had cited it, and you did. I'm just asking. There are parts in your brief where you know what a pin site citation is because you have a lot of them. Then there are other parts where one could seriously debate your conclusion, what it says. And there are no pin sites. And then you're asking us to go peck and find. You want us to read the whole decision and figure out that that's what it says. And that's not what the whole decision says. There's a couple of instances that are pointed out in the reply brief, if you want to know what I'm talking about. I just think, let's come on. What this case is about is Mr. Greggs, or whatever you want to call him, his conduct, okay? It's not the corporation. It's what the conduct, what he was to do. And you say, no, that's not the issue. Am I stating that correctly? That's a difference in viewpoint between you and the plaintiff?
It is not. No, that is not our position.
What is your position then? Their position is he, you know, it was about him and what was presented to him and what he had to do and decisions he had to make. You just keep talking about Hollister. So you need to clarify that.
Yes, thank you. Hollister's position is that with regard to the Section 20 claim, Mr. Meyer cannot state a Section 20 claim unless the conduct that Mr. Murphy engaged in was a violation of a law, rule, or regulation.
The problem is, and I will not say it again, he's already done that. You said he can't state. He stated it. That's what a 619 motion is. Okay? So, you know, you're not going to convince us the 619 and 615 are exactly the same. You're not. But you just said it very well. State. We aren't looking at what he stated is there. Okay? Now, if you contest those facts, summary judgment, sometime after discovery, he didn't claim it. You didn't talk about a claim. He just talked about his state.
With my remaining time, Your Honors, if you would allow me
sure.
to have a couple of more moments.
Sure.
With regard to the retaliatory discharge claim, count two, Mr. Meyer didn't, two points. He didn't hold a reasonable belief that he would be violating a matter of a clearly mandated policy, a matter of public policy. And in that regard, I would draw the court's attention to the Rabin versus
But again, he didn't hold a reasonable belief. Question of fact. This is again a 619. He says I did. You say you didn't. I agree. You can contest it. But the appropriate place is not here because you haven't said anything to why this completely negates. You said these are the facts and I disagree with the facts in the claim.
Your Honor, in the Rabin case, the court found as a matter of law on a 2615 motion that the plaintiff did
not. But this is not a 2615 motion.
But I'm addressing the excuse me if I didn't make that clear. I'm addressing the 2615, the 2615. Excuse me, Your Honor. Excuse me. I'm addressing the. Let me just go back for a moment to my notes.
Okay.
Yes, excuse me, Your Honor. What I'm arguing is you are absolutely right, Your Honor. The trial judge dismissed the retaliatory discharge count under a 2619A9. We argued at the trial court level that the complaint also could have been dismissed with prejudice under section 215. And that's the argument I'm making.
Well, you don't need to make that argument because we're not going to decide it. It wasn't something that the court decided.
Moving to the retaliatory discharge, moving to the promissory estoppel count 3 and the fraudulent inducement count 4, the trial court correctly found that Mr. Meyer cannot rely upon the anti-retaliation provisions in the Hollister Code of Conduct and in the anti-retaliation provisions on Hollister's website because he already had a duty under Illinois Rule of Professional Conduct 1.3 as an attorney for Hollister to report unethical conduct completely unrelated to the Code of Conduct, completely unrelated to the website materials, which contain the anti-retaliation provisions. Second, he had the duty under the business ethics policy that was in existence at the time he commenced employment, which also required him to notify management of any activity that would jeopardize Hollister's ability to conduct business in accordance with laws and regulations and high ethical standards. That did not contain an anti-retaliation provision. Thirdly, he always knew that his employment was at will and that the anti-retaliation provisions didn't change his at-will status. Counsel for plaintiff referred to, argued that the code of conduct is in fact it is a writing that amends the at-will employment provision in Mr. Meyer's employment agreement, but it isn't an agreement. It is a Mr. Meyer's employment agreement at C-563 of the record, paragraph 15 says that this agreement may be changed, altered, or modified only by an agreement in writing signed by the president of Hollister. No other person has the authority to change, alter, or modify.
It was signed by the president of Hollister, wasn't it?
But it's not an agreement. It says
an agreement. When somebody is to be bound by a code, that's not an agreement between employer and employee. Is that your position?
That is correct, Your Honor. It is not an
agreement. Codes of conduct do not apply to employees in Illinois because what?
They do.
Some addition, change, whatever, it doesn't become part of your agreement?
It is a policy, but it is not an agreement as...
Agreement. It's a policy. You don't have to follow it. Or they don't have to follow it?
They do have to follow it, Your Honor. It's not an agreement.
They have to follow it. That means they can't fire you for reporting something, correct? If they have to follow it, then we have a live case here.
And lastly, with regard to the fraudulent inducement count, Mr. Meyer doesn't identify a document that he was fraudulently induced to sign because of the anti-retaliation policies. He claims that the Hollister Code of Conduct is the document, but that's the very document that contains the anti-retaliation provisions, and you can't rely upon the document that contains the promise, if you will, to say that was the fraud. And that's the Colagrossi versus Royal Bank of Scotland case. He tries to circumvent that problem by arguing that the head of human resources for Hollister back in 2015 told him that if he reported dishonest conduct, that he wouldn't be fired. But Illinois law is clear is that a statement that, a statement that's made today can't constitute fraud for an action that the plaintiff takes after the statement is made. And that's the, you know, that's the Avon Hardware Company versus Ace Hardware Corp case, 2013 ILAP first.
Yeah, I read that case. You didn't give us a pin site on it. And I would contest that, that's what it says, but that be it as a way. That had to do with financials. Did you disagree with me? Did it have to do with financials?
It did have to do with financials, Your Honor.
I don't see the relevance in this case. And the fact that you had no pen site seems to me that you do too, because it's a general, you're saying it's the holding in the case, which it is. Tell me if I'm wrong. I mean, I'm making these statements because I'm just going through my mind and I want to make sure I hear, you know, we've given you a lot of time because I want you to get your arguments out. And I want you to hear, you know, some thoughts that have been going through my mind reading the briefs.
Thank you, Your Honor. I didn't see when I cited it, and I'm not certain I see now the distinction between, certainly there's factually a difference, but the fact that Avon dealt with financial statements as opposed to a statement, the statement that Ms. Erickson made, stating that back in 2015, that if you report what you believe is wrongful conduct, you won't be fired. I don't think that present time, present statement in 2015 can support a fraud claim for Mr. Meyer reporting Mr. Murphy.
In 2018, 3 years later,
And lastly, I would like to point out that in his argument, Mr. Plaintiff's counsel stated that there were antitrust, that Mr. Meyer mentioned antitrust violations. The record doesn't support that. There's no place in the record that says either in the original complaint, the amended complaint, or in the plaintiff's briefing that mentions antitrust violations. So, Your Honors, thank you very, very much for your time. I do appreciate it. And in conclusion, Hollister respectfully requests that the court affirm all of the trial court's rulings. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Reply, please.
Yes, Your Honors. A couple of quick things. First of all, admittedly, we did not attach the code of conduct to the complaint, nor did we attach any of these emails back and forth between my client, Greg Meyer, and Mr. Murphy, because when Greg was fired, and even in the days before when he was a little nervous, Greg did the ethical thing. He did the right thing. He didn't secrete out documents belonging to his company. That's why he didn't have them. That's why we don't attach the code of conduct. We don't know what it says. We don't know if it says it's a contract. We don't know if it says it augments the policy. Greg signed it. He had a chance to review it. He reviewed it carefully, but this happened sometime later. And just a couple of other quick items. Defendant's counsel refers to this as a whole bugaboo. This is not a bugaboo. This is somebody's life. This is somebody's livelihood. This is a lawyer. This is one of us who was put in an ethical situation that none of us ever wishes that they would have to be put in. And when he was put in that position, he did the right thing. I would like to take just a moment to respond to a few of the arguments related to counts 3 and 4 that Hollister's counsel ended with. First of all, as to both counts 3 and 4, there were their contesting of whether Greg had a rule of professional conduct, rule 1.13, duty to report what he believed was wrongful conduct, is entirely shot down by the plain allegations of the complaint, which must be taken as true. Those allegations show that there was no rule 1.13 duty here. Greg did not believe that there was a likelihood of substantial harm to the company. We're talking about legal budgets you know, I don't want to get into specific numbers because that's highly confidential information, but you can imagine for a large company like Hollister, it is quite a large number. It's far, far, far larger than $43,000. He didn't think that there was a substantial likelihood. He also didn't believe that anybody was going to be violating the law. He didn't think he was going to be violating the law because he refused. And he didn't think that Mr. Murphy was going to be violating the law because he told Mr. Murphy, no, don't do this. I will not participate in this. And then Mr. Murphy sent it up to his boss, who sent it up to his boss, who sent it to an outside firm. So all that time, Mr. Mayor, Greg, did not believe that there was anything to report. Second, as we discussed earlier, this 2007 contract, we believe, and we certainly allege in our complaint, was augmented by the code of conduct. So Greg was no longer a purely 100% at-will employee. We'd like to contest it more, but we don't have the code of conduct. We don't have the code of conduct because Greg didn't steal it and because we haven't gone through discovery. Third, this business ethics document that they talk about, as we pointed out to the trial court, they failed to provide that document to us when Greg's employment lawyer asked for his employment file. Therefore, should this case move forward, it's entirely off limits. We also allege in our complaint that Greg never was shown this supposed 2002 document, this one-page document. He never signed it. It wasn't attached or referenced in his employment contract. All of these things are complete questions of fact that need to be gotten at through discovery. And that's a big point here. You know, they talk about for the very first time this Llewellyn versus Schnadig case, and not to be too clever, but this was not found in any of their briefs. It was not found in their briefs to this court. It was not found in the briefs below.
We've gone over that.
Yes.
Anything else you have?
Well, I would like to end with this. One last point on fraudulent inducement. They claim that these were merely allegations of future promises. These were not allegations of future promises. As we allege in our complaint, they said at the time, we have put this code of conduct in place. As of today, you are protected. As of tomorrow, you're protected. As of 3 years from now, you are protected, even though Greg ultimately was not protected. This is highly different from the Avon case, which wasn't about a current promise that was made to Greg at that time. It was, though, that was a case about future financial projections. We all know how much future financial projections can change over time. This case is not about a bugaboo. This is about a man's life. This is about a man's livelihood. This is about an Illinois lawyer's honesty and integrity, somebody who made the tough decision, but the right decision to follow the Illinois Supreme Court rules. The circuit court gave short shrift in a skeletal, reed-thin dismissal that largely cut and pasted from its previous dismissal, that cited no case law for support, in a situation where all Hollister did is not accept the well-pled allegations, but instead raised not true fact question after not true fact question after not true fact question. This case should be reversed and remanded for discovery. Thank you, Your Honors.
I want to thank both of you very much for your briefs and for your arguments. I know we are an active bench, and I will say before my colleagues that you both handled yourself very well. So I appreciate that. We'll take the case under advisement.